The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Hi, I'm Claire Williamson and this is A Little Bit Booked on Fresh FM. If you catch a yawn or two,
that one was real actually.
Apologies. I've just come back from Chicago, where the entire family was celebrating my grandma's 100th birthday. Out of curiosity, I went to look up the most popular book published in 1926. And according to Publishers Weekly, the best-selling book was called The Private Life of Helen of Troy by John Erskine. I've never heard of it. History is also a near and dear subject to Karen State, who is joining me today to talk about her career as a historical researcher and writer. A former journalist, Karen has authored well over a dozen regional, social, and community history books, many of which focus on the local Nelson-Tasman area. And she received a Queen's Service Medal in 2017 for her historical research and services to the community. And beyond all of that, she remains heavily involved in the City of Nelson Civic Trust, the Rotary Club of Whakatū, and probably some more organizations I'm forgetting to name. Karen, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you, Claire, because I've been waiting forever to be invited.
Oh, glad to make you wait too long. What have you been reading recently?
Well, in December, my book group finished up for the year with a challenge, and that was to read memoir, biography, or autobiography. So I've read quite a few books on that sort of genre. So I've read Finding Private Weber, A Daughter's Search to Understand the Legacy of War, and that's by Angela Fitchett, who's a local writer, about her father's war story, and more importantly, the impact of those experiences on his life and family when he got home. And I've done No, I Don't Get Danger Money, Confessions of an Accidental War Correspondent by Lisette Raymer, who was News Hub's last European correspondent. And she had a great story to tell to Kiwi television audiences, you know, about going to the Queen's Jubilee and then, of course, the funeral or the announcement of her death first, then the big funeral and the coronation. But as a war correspondent, an accidental one, she went to Ukraine and Gaza. So a lot of the book is about her experiences there. It's really good. I also did John and Paul, A Love Story and Songs by Ian Leslie. So if you're into the Beatles, it's awesome because every chapter is a song title. And then it discusses the relationship between John and Paul from those very early years when they meet as teenagers until, of course, John Lennon's very unfortunate and untimely death through assassination. I've just started Everything But the Medicine.
Oh, that's
Doctor's
been on my
tale.
List.
It's awesome. Lucy O'Hagan, memoir by a New Zealand GP, and it's about the relationship between doctor and patient, and it's fascinating. Really short chapters, really snappy. It's really good.
Why did your book group set up this particular challenge?
I don't know that there was any particular reason. It was just, what are we going to read? Because there's always a couple of months where we don't have books. And for some reason, we chose that. And I mean, that's what I predominantly read. I do read fiction. But as I guess as a history writer, I love reading real stories. So I always have an autobiography or memoir or whatever on the go. So some of them when we met last week had not read any. I probably made up for it by going through that many.
Reading all of them and then probably some extra ones.
There was some fiction as well. Yeah, absolutely.
There was a big Yoko Ono art exhibit on in Chicago when we were there. And so we went through all of that. I didn't know that much about her art practice, kind of separate to her relationship with the Beatles. But then I learned that she was, you know, born in like 1933. So she's actually not that much younger than my grandma. She's still alive and kicking.
That's true. Yeah, she's quite elderly now and still going strong. So, yeah, she's one tough lady, that one.
Walk me through then. So, you know, we've started talking about the kind of books you enjoy and why you're drawn to memoir and autobiography and all of these topics. But walk me through the broad strokes of your career. Do I have it right? You started in print and radio journalism.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've always loved reading and I've always loved writing. And but when I was at school, it was never a thing. You know, you worked in a bank, you worked in a shop, you were a nurse, you were a teacher. And actually, that didn't suit me at all. And it wasn't until my English teacher at kind of sixth form said to me, be a journalist, because I worked on the school newspaper circuit at Nayland College. And I thought, you mean they pay people to do this? You know, I'd never thought of it. And so I did. I went and did my journalism training and I came back to the Nelson Evening Mail, who actually were great supporters of circuit. They printed it. And so I did all sorts of different rounds there. I loved it. But when I went and left to do my OE and came back, there was no job for me. They said that if there was, I'd get a job, but there didn't happen to be one. And so I cast around and I actually worked for Doc for a 3 months. I was their first journalist while they decided did they need one or not. That was an interesting period. But then I ended up in Radio Nelson in the newsroom. And I'd never done radio before. I had done training in radio for a week in my training, but I was 18 when I did my training, so I sounded really squeaky. So I got a no pass for radio at that age, but I was a little bit older by the time I started. And, of course, back in those days, it was under Radio New Zealand. All the provincial newsrooms were part of Radio New Zealand, and we had to do voice training. So I had to learn to lower my voice and speak slower and, you know, clearer.
What's your trick? What's the trick to get in the right, like, radio voice?
Well, I think I do actually imagine myself back in the studio. And Martin, my husband, always says, oh, she's using her radio voice. So anyway, I love that because it was really fast and furious. But I couldn't do it long term. So I actually left to have Troy. And when he was, I think it was about 2.5, I was tapped on the shoulder to go to teach journalism at an entry level at Nelson Polytechnic, as it was then. So I got to use my radio skills and my newspaper writing skills to teach students the basics of radio journalism. And so it's kind of fun being here in Fresh FM because Matt Budd is just behind us and he was one of my best students. So, you know, we did well and I really enjoyed it. But unfortunately, you know, through restructuring, I think I went through three restructures while I was at Nelson Polytech that then became Nelson Marlborough Institute of Technology while I was there. Anyway, eventually they paid me out, which was a shame because that was the end of that course. Mm. And then I was like, well, where to from there? So I did a few freelance gigs and I wrote for the Mail and I did a consumer page and feature sort of thing and some real estate writing, all sorts of different things. But I didn't, that's not what I wanted to do. And my passion's always been history. You know, even from a young thing, I loved history. I used to sit and pore through the Encyclopedia Britannica. I mean, you know, there were certain topics, history topics, the royals, a whole lot of things I loved. So that's why I thought I should try and do something like that. But how do you get into that? Well, the opportunity came when Troy was at Central School and they were planning their 125th anniversary reunion and I was on the reunion committee because I love reunions. Some people hate
history
them.
History in action.
Oh, my God. I love reunions. I want to know all about what you've been doing in the last 25 years, right?
Have you thought about that? That's maybe why some people get intimidated by reunions because they know someone's going to want to know everything.
I'm sure. And sometimes I have to haul myself out and think, don't interrogate people. Like I'm trying to be interested in people because I am genuinely interested in people.
I think you have to be.
But sometimes it possibly comes across as a bit of an interrogation and people go, whoa, you know. Anyway, that's probably why some people stay away from reunions. I don't know. Anyway, I was on the reunion committee and Maurice G had written the centennial book and they were saying, oh, we should update that, you know, the next 25 years. And they all kind of turned and looked at me and I thought, well, why not? So I wrote the 125th Jubilee book for Nelson Central School. And I really, really enjoyed it. I didn't get paid for it. I did it voluntarily, you know, because I don't know. How do you write a book? I've never written a book. So anyway, I wrote a book and the principal, Paul Potucker, was really, really supportive. And in the end, he persuaded me that I could go to university and do the history degree I'd never done, because when I did my journalism training, they actually preferred you did not have a university degree. Oh. My tutors at Auckland Institute of Technology hated university graduates because they felt they were too academic, and that's not what you want in a news journalist. Mm. So I never went to university and never got the degree. And I thought, well, you know, maybe now's the time. And Paul really encouraged me. So I hold him up as one of my most important mentors, along with Diana Sherrill, who's my was their English teacher at Nayland College, who said, be a journalist. It's great. So anyway, I did extramural study at Massey University and loved it. History, obviously, I just chose these amazing papers with an idea of starting from really early stuff and going through all the New Zealand papers. But I never got there. I got half a degree.
Mm. You could always go back.
Well, I could, but you see, I mean, I would love to finish it. But the fact of the matter is I got too busy, because that school book I did for Central School led to two more. Paul was talking to other principals, and Richmond School was turning 150, and then Tahuna Nui School turned 100. And before you know it, I was so busy researching and interviewing and writing, I didn't have time to also research and write history papers for a degree. So I still don't have that degree. But I'm doing the same amount of work. But what I did learn in those papers has been really helpful, and that primarily has been doing referencing, how to do referencing and the importance of it, and bibliographies and indexing. And I was ace at those. I got top marks and got special comments for it. So I know I was on the right track with that, and it's been really, really, really helpful to me. So, yeah, it's just kept going. And so I've been really fortunate to carve out a niche in this community, Top of the South community, in writing history. So, I've always asked questions, I've researched and I've written. So whether it's been newspapers or radio or features, even researching stuff for when I was teaching. I also worked for the Nelson Provincial Museum writing exhibitions. So all those skills came to the fore there.
It all sounds like applied curiosity.
It is. And I think, well, I do think, you know, they say that you can't teach someone to be a journalist unless they're naturally curious, or some would say nosy, hence the questions, right? And so you do have to be really, you have to keep saying, you know, or asking who, what, where, why, when, how, you know, that's the basis of it. And so that is what I do. And so that's held me in good stead. And so now, you know, I really do get people come to me. I'm not out there searching for work. I have a list. I have a wait list of work. And every now and then it gets to the stage where there's nothing coming up and I think, oh, my God, what am I going to do? What am I going to write next? You know, where am I going to get money? And before I know it, I've got two or three people wanting a book written. So.
And of course, it's always at the same time.
Oh,
what a fortuitous problem to have.
Well, yeah, it's always just before Christmas or over the summer, or literally someone wants something the week before you're due to go overseas. I mean, that's just how it works.
You can never
out,
leave
you know.
Ever again.
Yeah,
Karen.
Yeah.
You can only be in Nelson.
Yeah, but you know, it is fun, and I am lucky that I have been able to carve out that niche, because it's a small market, and no one else is. Well, I mean, there are writers who are doing history, but. You know, that is what I do. I don't do anything else now, you know.
Aside from your natural curiosity, what skills did you take away from your time in media, whatever you learned on the job or learned through teaching? And, you know, I mean, there's kind of the obvious ones like chasing down leads or getting people to open up to you when you know there's a story there.
I guess sometimes it's looking at a story from a different angle, and it's not always obvious. You might go in thinking you're talking to someone about this particular subject, and their answer might should, and sometimes, you know, it leads in another direction, and you've got to be clued in enough to listen out for that and follow that up. And we had a prime example when I was doing radio of a reporter who was so focused on the next, you know, getting ready for the next question that she missed a vital answer.
Oops.
That should have led her to something else, and it wasn't until it was the recording was listened back to with the chief reporter that the chief reporter went, "Oh my God, there's the story." The interview subject had just announced something quite major, and it was completely missed by the reporter.
So it's almost like you can't have pre-written someone's story in your head.
No, you can't. No, you can't. And that's what often happens in a book, because people say, "How long is it going to take?" Or, you know, "How many chapters?" What you don't know what you don't know. And so you might have an outline. I mean, we should all go in with an outline, but you don't know where it might take you, and you have to be prepared to change course.
Mm.
And so books often turn out quite differently than you might expect them to turn out.
Or I assume even as the person it's about expects them to turn out.
Completely, yeah, yeah. I mean, I had one client who, there was no deadline. It was just, "Let's just keep going." And it was a family history, and he would just say, "That's fascinating. Let's keep going down that line." So, and then we're like, "Oh, I really want to do that line." And it just kept going and going and going. And, you know, that was three volumes over 3 years, that one. But so you do not know. And some interesting ones, like I did the Nelson Club 150th anniversary. So that's the men's social club here.
Veritable
it's
institution.
Men only. Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, I felt the fact that they asked a woman to write it was, you know, quite a major coup in itself. But I really enjoyed that project. It was fascinating, the social history of that club and clubs like that. So, you know, finding out about why clubs, men's clubs, social clubs started, and, you know, what their purpose was and all that kind of stuff. But, of course, as a woman, I was quite fascinated by the role of women in the club. And they couldn't be members, but they came into the club and by invitation to certain social things and all that sort of thing. But when I went through all the minute books, and you can imagine over 150 years, there's a lot of them, women kept coming up, and there were certain topics related to them that kept coming up. And so I followed those lines. And so in that book, which was launched a couple of years ago, there's an entire chapter on women. Now, if a man had written that book,
oh, that wouldn't have been in there.
There would not have been a chapter on women. Women would have been mentioned. So, you know, you can sometimes, obviously, you know, prejudices, but it's,
you
know, my take on it is going to be different from something you might write or something a man might write or whatever. And so, you know, I think they're happy with the book, but it's just, you know, you don't know where that's going to go. And when I first started that book, I didn't realise I was going to be writing a whole chapter about women in a book about a men's club.
Before we keep going down kind of into some of the work you've been doing recently and how you approach researching and writing, so we're all on the same page, how are you defining social history? As opposed to, you know, when you go to school, you go to history class, you have history, but there's this kind of niche or subset.
Yeah, well, I think history was killed for many people by history books written in a really dry manner. You know, I think a lot of academic writing in history just, they forget the story, right? It's facts and figures, it's dates, it's laws, it's, I don't know, it's so
timelines.
Boring. But to me, the interesting thing is people that impact history and historical events, or events at the time, and they become historical, of course, have on people. So social history is the lived stories and experiences and social structures of ordinary people. So, yeah, I hope, and I think it's changing. I really think there's been a huge increase and passion for and respect for local history. You know, it's not that long ago, and I bet you still hear it now, people would say, "Oh, New Zealand doesn't have a history. It's too young. We have to go to Europe or America or whatever.
I don't think America's that much older, but yeah.
UK for history because New Zealand's too young. There's nothing here, you know, and it's really frustrating. And so for a long time it was ignored. And that's what our school curriculum taught too, was not New Zealand history. Everyone learned about, you know, the Napoleonic Wars or the, I don't know, the Civil War in America or all kings and queens in England or whatever it was, you know. And now we are actually learning about our story. And they are. They're our stories. So, I mean, you can use the word history, but history is just the story of people that were before. I mean, yeah, history's yesterday, let's face it. And so it's you know, the impact of decisions made by people usually higher up, the impact of those decisions and actions on people, that, you know, labourers and farmers and shopkeepers and mothers and the marginalised, whatever, and the subsequent development of things like labour, you know, social movements, and cultural habits. So we gain an understanding of how our society's changed. It's fascinating.
It's kind of the ground level view, I guess, of what has been happening at kind of the micro level of the macro environment.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about the, you know, Industrial Revolution and we hear all about, you know, what was going on up high. But how did that, what was the impact on the people on the ground? And so, for example, I worked with the Nelson Provincial Museum on a series of exhibitions during the centennial of World War One, and my particular focus was on the impact in Nelson on women and the migrant communities. Now, in those days, it was the Italians and it was the Germans. Well, obviously, the German community here in Nelson was on the wrong side in both wars, but the Italians were allies in the First World War. And then they joined the Axis power, so they were the enemy in World War II. So, you know, so there were those kinds of stories. That's what was fascinating. We did some soldier stories about the men, you know, the men at war. But more interesting to me was what happened at home while they were all gone. How did people cope, you know? And it's a far more interesting story than solely what's going on in war with the men. And, of course, it was men, nurses. Obviously, but they're not fighting, is interesting too. But more people then stayed behind than went. Was great.
Do you think of yourself more as a researcher, more as a writer, first and foremost? Or is it too intertwined to...
Well, it is, but separate. I guess, I mean, I've always been a writer. So ultimately people want me to write. But in order to write, I have to research. And I have to say, I love research. And the more I get into it, the more I love it. And, you know, someone just has to say something to me and I'm on my phone or in my desktop and I'm Googling it and I'm checking all these databases, and you can get really caught up in very deep and dark rabbit warrens. But there's nothing like a eureka moment. And I remember when I was doing a big family history, the one where the guy that commissioned me kept shooting off on all these different angles, which was fun. I lost one of the family. He was a baker, and he's with his family, and then he's not with his family.
Oh, so you mean you lost the research thread, not like you couldn't get in contact?
No, I couldn't.
Anymore.
Well, he was long dead. I was following him through all the census data records, you know, and he was there, and then he just was gone, and I couldn't work out where he'd gone. Like, he hadn't died. He was somewhere, and I just thought, I've got to find him, because he was a really important part of the story. And it took me a long time, but I found him in the debtor's prison. His wife was carrying on the bakery, and he had to bake in the prison in order to earn money to pay back his debts. And I do remember, I was like, yes. And I remember the excitement. I remember running outside and telling Martin, I found him.
And Martin's like, who?
What? Yeah.
What?
And it's like, you know, I'm not giving up. I'm going to find him. And so it's so much fun. Research is fun. And it's a lot easier now, because a lot of it is online, especially if you're doing genealogical stuff, you know. But a lot of organisations are digitising their records. It's just amazing what you can find. You have to know how to find it. But equally, it's fun going to somewhere like National Archives and delving into their records. And we did that when Karen Price and I co-wrote Pastor Prayer and Promise, The History of Nelson's Italian Community. And it was a five-year project, that one. Anyway, we spent a lot of time in National Archives in Wellington, and we gained early access through permission of the chief archivist of the war records of a whole lot of Italians.
Well, stuff that would have still been sealed for the minimum 50 years or whatever.
And it still is, of course, until 2040 to 2045, you know. Of course, they were aliens at that time. They were deemed aliens and enemy aliens at that. And so they had all had these interviews with a local lawyer who gave them a rating of A to E, and the higher the letter, the more dangerous they were deemed to be.
Great.
And so we had a lot of Italian families who didn't know some information, which was as basic as what year did they come here, why did they come here, when, who did they come with, you know, what was their address, all sorts of stuff like that. The interviews that were held and recorded by that lawyer had all that information, you know, and so it took a lot of effort to get the permission we needed from the families to access it, but then the value of opening those files, those locked files, and it, I wouldn't say it took the scab off, may have for some, some individuals, but in many other ways, it answered so many questions families had that they didn't think of asking grandma or mum back in the day, but now they wanted to know, so we could fill in all these gaps. Mm. It was so satisfying.
Is there kind of a difference in how you approach writing a book for a general audience versus someone who's approached you and they want a family history for them, maybe, and their and their relatives?
Definitely. Yeah. And sometimes they don't know themselves who it's for. Often it starts out, we want a family history. And then they get all excited because maybe I've found something else out that might be of interest to others. And then they go, oh, well, maybe we could sell it. You've got to be really careful with that, because I've interviewed family members. They've told me all sorts of stuff because it's for the family. They haven't told me it so that you, Claire, can find out about great Aunt Gertrude's rather unusual habit.
Oops.
You know, or something else that might have happened that was a little unsavoury or whatever. You know, there's a lot of shame in families often with things, and they, you know, they're a bit protective of it, rightfully so. So you've got to be really careful. And that has happened on a number of occasions. So it's difficult. I don't think there's any right answer to how you go about it, because they think they're going to have a book for one audience and then they think maybe there's another audience. One I wrote, Driven by the Wind, which was the maritime story of Captain Henry Rose, was commissioned by his great-grandfather, and Alistair wanted a book for this for the family. And as we went along, it was me that said, you know what, I think there's a wider audience for this book. So sometimes it works the other way. And that was one where that extra research that I was able to bring to the project certainly opened it up to a wider audience. The same happened with Apo Hocton, the book I did on New Zealand's first naturalised Chinese migrant. And that came about because a whole lot of research had been done within the museum with Apo's great-great-granddaughter, Diana Clark, and a report was going to be written, and it had never been written. So this was a report that would go into the museum library. So they brought me in to write the report. Well, as I went through it and I did a little bit more supplementary research, and then I thought, this is a book. This is a really interesting story. It shouldn't just be put in a folder and stuck in a shelf in the hope someone might find it one day. So with a little bit of persuasion and a grant that the Nelson Provincial Museum was able to get, we published a book, and then that led to an exhibition. So we launched the exhibition and the book, and that exhibition and that book has gone around schools and other museums, you know. So sometimes you don't know whether it's for the family or for the business. I mean, you know, I do business histories as well. But there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of interest in things. Like I'm doing one at the moment on a construction firm.
Mm.
Gibbons Construction. And they've been around for 75 years. And so it's a family business. And it's the story of that family business. And obviously there's family members going through it. So Karen Price and I are doing that one too. And that's been fascinating. Now, that is for the family and business and clients and, you know, tenants and all sorts of things like that. It's, as far as I'm aware, it's not going to be sold, but it could be. I don't know. But there are a lot of people interested in construction. And if it was a book about transport, you know, there's a lot of people interested in that. So people like that. I did a farming one. Well, people were fascinated by farming. So you never know. And, you know, I was saying there are things in every topic that are interesting. You just have to ask the right questions. So
that's good, because I wouldn't have said construction was terribly interesting. Sorry, Gibbons. Off the top of my head, if you just said, yeah, you know, I'm writing a book on construction, I'd be like, oh, great.
Yeah, well, you would think about, I guess, the buildings they've built. And, you know, Nelson City and around the region, they have built a lot of buildings. But the question is, what are they built of and how are they built and how has that changed? If we're doing a history of 75 years, building, construction has changed hugely, you know. So concrete, this is the thing I keep telling people now. Concrete is fascinating, right? Who would know? But
sorry, I'm laughing. Wait. Sorry. Tell me about concrete. I'm ready.
Karen and I now know all about concrete. So, you know, here I can remember, well, some people out there will remember when their dads were out there and they were literally mixing concrete up in a bucket with a bucket of water and a spade. You know, that's how it went. And then my dad bought a concrete mixer, you know, with the revolving barrel and the petrol motor, with all the neighbours when they first built their house.
Went in together to get,
yeah,
like,
and
a
they
communal.
Shared it because they were all laying driveways and paths and garden edgings and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, there was that kind of concrete that mixed more than could be mixed in just a bucket. And so it moves up and up till they're putting it in trucks and mixing it at a site. They pour it into a truck and the truck races down the road to the building site and they you know, shovel it all out. But what if there's a road closure or a traffic jam and the concrete sets in the truck? That doesn't work. So what do you do? So then, you know, they start doing the revolving drums on the trucks. So they pour it in and it rolls around so it doesn't, you know, doesn't set, and they get it there and unload it, pour it out. They can actually pour it out by now. But then the next one is transit mix. They mix the concrete while they're travelling. Like, it's literally being mixed while they're travelling. So it doesn't sound very interesting, but it's stuff like that you think, oh, yeah. I mean, you think when you're building back in the day, concrete was used in foundations and everything else was timber or brick. Now they're building, you know, tilt slabs. They lay out big slabs of concrete that they then lift into place, and suddenly there's your walls. So even how they do that over the years, how that's changed. There's some fascinating stories. I love the story of the time that the concrete went in and they made a miscalculation about how it was going to go and how long it was going to take, and it was going to start going off and all these trucks were rolling up with more and more concrete and they couldn't get it out fast enough. And they called in all the staff that were in the office that day, including the office ladies, who all rolled on down there, and, you know, hopefully
everyone's shoveling concrete.
And they were all shoveling concrete and wheelbarrowing it into the building site. So, you know, stuff like that just makes it so interesting, so fascinating.
I would love to hear an office lady memory of that day at the office.
Wouldn't it be awesome if we could find one of the office ladies? Maybe that's something we'll have to try and do.
Well, I'm just imagining, like, they'd come home all spattered in concrete and it would have been their nice office pumps, and then their husband would have been like, what happened to you? Or the kids. And
that's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there were some high heels involved.
Oh, that's what it's like, the dog paw prints on concrete that's been poured, except there's all these little tiny holes and it matches up to like a stiletto instead. If these books take, you know, you think of anyone who's writing a book, like, it takes years. And you're researching and writing, and that's years. How do you keep yourself and, like, the people you're working with, like, passionate and engaged about the project?
Ooh, That's an interesting one. I think the people that commission are constantly fascinated and interested because they're paying the bill. So they would like it done as quickly as possible. But I think it's the reports back. So like the monthly reports about what you found, because that's when you can reveal some of those wee gems, like the eureka moment with John, you know, the baker, and suggesting things, you know, about what we can do next or where. And I mean, the thing is, sometimes I'm writing to a deadline because there's a family reunion, there's a something's coming up, right? Other times there is no deadline because they don't really know how long it's going to take, and I certainly don't because I don't even know what they've got yet. It's very hard to quote on these projects because I have no idea at the start what I'm going to find, let alone where it's going to take me. So I do think it's just that communication backwards and forwards about where we're at and where we're going. So the Gibbons one at the moment, I'm writing the very last chapters at the moment. So they are now reading the early chapters, making changes, corrections, whatever. So they're currently learning their story. And as one of them said, you know more about our family than we do. I hope not, but, we've found stuff out that they don't know and that is fascinating. And, talking with former colleagues of theirs and workers or clients, whatever, all adds little bits of colour to what, a construction history, like you say, could be really dull. It could be so dry. It could be worthy but dull.
Mm.
And the trick is to make it fascinating so you want to turn the next page. So if you want to know about concrete, you get a hold of that book and you'll learn so much about it.
Oh, but, you think about, 100 years from now, honestly, someone probably will want to know about concrete.
They will. And I really appreciate books like that tell me the process. So one of the things we had to look at was Bill Gibbons used to do, he used to build kilns, tobacco kilns. It's actually quite hard getting information about how a tobacco kiln was built and how it was used in a way that a reader would understand now.
Is this not just for drying tobacco for cigarettes, or is this something completely different?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we're way back in the days when Nelson first started growing tobacco for production, pouch tobacco and cigarettes, So it was a huge industry in Motueka and around the Motueka Valley. Hmm. And that's what he used to do. And even getting a photo of one was difficult. So, so people who've written books before or written reports for, say, the Cawthron Institute or whatever, we love those. That's what we want. So hopefully what we're writing now may be used in that way by someone in the future too.
I guess it's like when you read a book and someone's written a sentence like blah, 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 who everybody knows, and then they keep going, but they actually haven't said anything about the person they name dropped or the method that they mentioned. And then because they don't realize that in 150 years, actually no one will know what they're talking about.
Do you know one of the worst things is people refer to businesses and they say, oh, that was at H&J Smith. Well, I know where J Smith was. You don't.
No, I have no idea what you're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. Because it closed before you came to Nelson, right? So street numbers are important, although they can change. Note to self, they can, yeah, in businesses and that. But in town, it's no good saying it was next to H&J Smith's, because H&J Smith's is long gone. So that is something we've actually for the Gibbons one is with garages and things, because a lot of the old car garages have, and I mean garages as in service station, motor mechanics, all that stuff, a lot of them have long gone. And it's trying to find out where on Hardy Street it was, or where on Rutherford Street or whatever. So that's something I always try and do, because I know in future they won't know. That reference will be meaningless.
You're writing for future historians in some part.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, this leads very nicely to the fun question I wanted to do, which is, as we've kind of been talking, like, people don't realize what's important, or people don't realize that their own family history can get lost, and then someone has to spend hours, probably longer, basically wading through becoming a historical detective. for people who were interested in their own family's history, like what, you know, couple questions should everyone go ask their parents or grandparents right now? Or what should they start with?
Okay, well.
That's probably hard, sorry.
Yeah, no, it's the questions is one thing because, I mean, I think people, we know when someone was born, we know when they got married, we sometimes know when they had children, not all the time, and we know when they died. That tends to be the stuff. And we probably know that mum went to Auckland Point School, but we're not quite sure. But you can find that out. But actually, I think there's a whole lot of other questions that are quite interesting. And I was just visiting my mum just before this interview, and I happened to mention something, and it got her going. It sparked the old brain, and she said, I've got to get a notebook and write some of these things down. Actually, we're talking about smoking. How about that?
Oh, tobacco.
I know, right? And so she started to remember the first time she realised that her clothes smelt of smoke because her father smoked all the time. So she grew up in it, and it wasn't until we three kids would arrive home from a weekend staying with the grandparents and we smelled of smoke all of a sudden, our clothes did, that she realised she probably had all those years ago.
To be fair, so would everyone else,
you know,
probably.
Well, that's what I said. It was, you know, of its time. But I think that's one of the things, is childhood memories about where they lived and actual addresses, different, you know, family activities they remember, what they did when they went on holiday, where they went on holiday, you know, how they met whoever they married or maybe their first love or whatever it was, and what sort of jobs they had and where they had them. And so, you know, as I say, what was the address as well, not just what the job was. What they got paid, you know, in a number of books I've done, men particularly can tell me exactly what they got paid in their first wage packet. You know, and so that's kind of interesting when you start using those figures and converting that. With inflation and all that, you know. It's kind of interesting.
For posterity, my first high school job was US $7.50 an hour, the minimum wage, filing membership information in manila envelopes in the tennis club back office and re-alphabetizing their system every summer.
Well, there you go. See, that's a good thing to put down, right? Yeah, it's really interesting. Schools they went to, their first car, their favourite outfits. Like my mum can tell you all about the clothes she made for herself and how she'd work all, you know, through the week to sew a gown for some, I don't know, dance she was going to on Saturday night or something. So I think there's stuff like that. It just, again, it rounds them out as people rather than just those Billy basics, you know. It just makes them it makes them real. I think that's a really good thing.
As opposed to, like, again, the boring, a name, a date, and a number.
Yeah, because you often do get that in books. And, I mean, sometimes I have to write that because it is all I know. But if you can add in a bit of colour, you know, what was your mum's favourite colour? There you go. I don't know. I must ask her. I know what she wears now. But the other thing, I think, is not what you ask but what you collect. And so as someone who writes history, and even from that very first book I did for Central School, I realised there is a major problem for historians looming, and that is digital photos. So back in the day, and we probably can all remember, our parents, and I mean I have them, boxes and boxes of photos, boxes of negatives or packets of negatives, and those big boxes of slides. I mean, my dad, you know, it's nothing better on a Saturday night to get a whole lot round and get the projector out and show all the slides off. Well, you can't use those now. So digitisation. So the problem is, though, that digitisation, it means you don't have prints anymore. And on phones, which most of us are now taking photos on, you just hit delete. When you fill up your phone,
it goes into the cloud somewhere and you have actually no idea where it's
going. I know. And so historians in the future are going to struggle with images. There are not going to be images. And there may be images. There will probably be thousands of images, but they're not labelled. They're not dated. They do get dated, I suppose, on your phone.
I guess there's some metadata, yeah, maybe.
You know, it's not going to tell you who they are, where they are, what they're doing. And that's what I found even all the way back in 2003 with a Central School book, was we had acres of photos showing kids and teachers doing stuff, and that's all I could tell you. I couldn't put them in years. I couldn't say it was that class going to that camp. Or
here are some kids on the playground.
I know. That's exactly what it was. So I probably had photos of what I wanted. I just couldn't identify them. So that is a big thing, is if you've got really special photos of family or something you really want to keep, I do suggest you take them off your phone, save them in folders with proper names and dates. But also, there's nothing wrong with still having a few actual prints as long as you write on the back.
Mm.
Yeah, that is a real shame. We had that with Pastor Prayer and Promise. Lots of beautiful, beautiful studio photos of people. Inbox and albums, no names, no nothing. Have no idea if they were friends or whether they're people we actually wanted to put in the book. I don't know. So that's a really, really major issue. So I think those are the major things I think I would suggest people do.
So without a concerted effort to do this research and to preserve your own history or kind of the history of your community, whether that's through photos or whether that's through record keeping or just keeping on top of this stuff, if you don't do that, what would you say communities, particularly in New Zealand regional communities, lose over time without people actively writing?
I think, well, they probably lose, I think they lose their own stories. You know, that social history gets lost. And I think, you know, we were talking earlier about diaries and letters.
Mm.
And you, Claire, I know, are a big letter writer. Like, you know, I mean,
boxes.
Actually handwriting letters, putting them in an envelope and putting a stamp on them. That's what we all used to do. And that's what historians use a lot of. But people don't write letters anymore. That's why New Zealand Post is going under. And people aren't writing diaries the same. And so that written record that people leave is also disappearing, which is another major thing. So I think, yeah, the stories, you know, some of the stories are quite small and they're very niche, but they all build up a picture of a town, a city, a region, a country, and the people and the belief systems and the social structures. And so I'm really glad that more and more of that kind of history is being written, but it's being written primarily by people with a passion. There's no money in it. Most people aren't in the situation I am where people are actually coming and wanting to pay me money to do it. Most of them just have a passion for a particular topic and they write it. They research it, they write it. They put a whole lot of their own money into it. It's very hard to get funding, especially at the moment with the economic downturn. You know, a whole lot of funding, or funds rather, are closing. And so there's far more competition for what is there. And so they just have to fund it themselves. It's actually really tough. So I applaud any of you out there who persevere and get something printed, because, you know, you are adding immeasurably to the region's historical record.
That's a pretty good way to wrap up, I think, with a few bookmarks to give everyone some bookish news of what's coming up. One is that the annual competition for National Flash Fiction Day is open through 30 April for stories of 300 words or less. And the judges this year are Ingrid Horrocks and Louise Wallace, both of whom are very cool. And people who are keen can enter at nationalflash.org/competition. And then there's some more applications open through 10 April for the 2026 Kupu Kaitiaki and Kaitsuhi Mentor Programs, which support the amplification of Maori voices and Maori stories. And people who are interested in applying for that can apply online at authors.org.nz. And that is it for today. You can find me and Karen online. I'm at Accidental Tokyoite, and Karen can be found at HistoryNZ. Am I saying that right?
Well,
how do you say it?
I say historians. But yeah, it is HISTORINZ.
.co.nz.
That's it.
Or at Karen Stade Nelson NZ on Instagram. So thank you for joining us in this little moment of history.
Thank you. It was fun.
Oh, good. And hopefully everyone's day has been a little bit booked.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.